Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
The aviation industry is relying on a massive ramp-up in production of what it calls sustainable aviation fuel over the next three decades to help meet its target of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. But even if every plane in the world was using this fuel by 2050, something that in itself is extremely unlikely, it would only reduce climate warming from the industry by around half, according to my next guest. Professor Gerry Murphy, Director of the Marai Centre in UCC. A very good morning to you.
Thank you, Philip, for the opportunity to present our science on RTE. It's greatly appreciated.
You have, as we say, been studying sustainable aviation fuel. Just outline for the listeners how hard a nut it is to crack here to decarbonise flying by 2050.
Oh, aviation is one of the hard to decarbonise sectors, and it's very, very challenging because there are so many planes in the sky at any one time. And in terms of carbon dioxide, the end product of combustion, aviation is responsible for 2% on a worldwide basis. So a massive, massive quantity of fuel. And I suppose the area of concern in our recent research is that when we look at climate warming, it's not only the CO2, which is the combustion of the fuel, but because we burn the fuel at 33,000 feet, there are other elements that are causing warming, such as the contrails and water vapour and particulate matter. And there's a gas called NOx. So typically, half of the warming comes from the carbon dioxide in the fuel, but half comes because we're burning the fuel at such a high altitude.
So when leaders of the aviation industry say, ah, but come on, we only account for 2% of global warming, that's not an accurate figure, you're saying?
No, it's not an accurate figure in terms of the warming impact of aviation. And this is a concern because SAF is very, very complex.
Sustainable aviation fuel.
Sustainable aviation fuel, which we call SAF, it's a very complex fuel, but it's very expensive fuel. But if all planes ran on sustainable aviation fuel, we would be reducing the warming effect by about half. So this is very, very challenging. And I suppose when we look at sustainable aviation fuel and the vast quantity, and we look at what are the technologies to make that fuel, initially we would look at land and we would look at fuels produced from biomass. So typically oils. We talk about used cooking oil, but that's a small quantity. We look at rapeseed oil, mustard seed oil. So you could imagine on your dinner table at home, you probably have a jar of oil. Like the amount of oil needed to replace all aviation fuel is absurd. It's such a large quantity. And oil of itself...
Well, go on, how much? I mean, if we were to devote all of that arable land to keeping on flying at the rate that we're doing now, how much land would be taken out of agricultural production?
You see, the problem is we have 0.2 hectares of arable land per person. And the population is growing. So we cannot afford to run aviation on biomass, because another issue is that shipping, which is a similar order of magnitude, will also need fuel. When we look at battery technology, and there's a lot of interest in electrification, a battery is quite big, it's quite heavy, and it's fine for cars that travel 300 kilometres. It's okay for trucks that go 400 kilometres. But if you wanted to put a battery on a plane to go from London to Dubai, the battery would be bigger than the plane. So we have to have hydrocarbons. And we need renewable hydrogen molecules and renewable carbon molecules. So our thesis is that biofuels isn't enough. There is not enough biofuels. So the next area of interest, we call it ESAF, or sustainable aviation fuel made from electricity. And this has a large resource. If we look at Ireland, for example, we have an auction pipeline for 17 gigawatts of offshore wind. And as a country, we've never used more than six. So across the planet, we will overproduce renewable electricity. And the reason we will overproduce is that we can use electricity to make hydrogen. And we need hydrogen for fuels. So when I look at a liquid fuel, it's a hydrocarbon. There's a hydrogen molecule and a carbon molecule. So we'll get our hydrogen from offshore wind. It'll be expensive, but we can do it. We can do enough hydrogen from offshore wind and PV on the planet. But the second element in the fuel is carbon dioxide. And I know it's a problem, but we need carbon dioxide to make fuel. So we build these huge facilities that will suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. So we take air, we pass it through a membrane, and CO2 is about 0.04% of air. So it costs about 500 euros a ton to get carbon dioxide. We react that with hydrogen from offshore wind, and we can make eSAF. But it's a huge ask. It's a huge ask. It's very, very, very expensive. And then...
Can I just pick you up on the hydrogen thing for one moment, and let's simplify this a little bit. We're still talking about vast amounts of energy in order to generate the hydrogen so that we can put as many people in planes as we are currently. I saw one estimate suggested that an airport like Heathrow would need the equivalent of four small modular nuclear reactors worth of energy to make all of that hydrogen.
Yeah, it's a very large amount. I mean, when we look at offshore wind, which is what we will do in Ireland, we won't do nuclear. We have a target of 7 gigawatts of offshore wind by 2032. That's 467 Eiffel Tower sized structures in the ocean. I mean, it's hard enough to imagine one Eiffel Tower in the ocean. We need 467 offshore wind devices in the ocean by 2032 to match our climate plan. So, like, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at huge Eiffel Towers, big electrolyzers making hydrogen, and that's only for the hydrogen molecule. The other side is we will have massive facilities sucking air and creating CO2, and then you react the hydrogen from the offshore wind with the CO2 from this facility to make eSAF, electrical sustainable aviation fuel.
So whether it is fuel from hydrogen or from biomass or whatever the source is, when the industry says that it can be done by 2050, that it will reach its own net zero target by that stage, are they overpromising?
Well, I mean, we've just explained the technologies, which are very, very challenging. And if we did all that, that's a reduction of half of the warming of aviation, because we're still creating a fuel that'll be burned at 33,000 feet, that will have contrails, fine material and NOx, which will cause warming. So this massive industry and technology and expenditure will roughly half aviation warming.
Okay, it sounds to me like you're moving in the direction of saying that there's going to be a massive outlay here. It's only going to achieve half of what needs to be done. And this is an industry that intends on expanding at, I think, at about 2.5% per annum. So really, is the alternative that you're about to prescribe that we all start flying a lot less?
Well, I think what's going to happen, and I lived in England in the 1980s. My salary was £10,000 a year and my flight to Cork was £200. So it was a 50th of my salary. And at the moment, we can pop off to Seville for a weekend and pay, I don't know, 25 euros a flight. I think that will be gone. If we have net zero, the cost of flying is going to be very, very high as compared to now, and probably at a level it was in the 70s. So I think the number of people flying will reduce.
So what does that mean, Jerry? Does that mean that a flight to London would be of the order of 300 or 400 euro? A flight across the Atlantic would be of the order of 2,000 or 3,000 euro?
I would think so, and maybe more, because if we are looking at net zero, and I'm going back to technology, the other 50%, which we don't take with SAF, will have to be pulled out of the atmosphere with this direct air carbon capture, which is even a further expense for true net zero aviation. So I don't think we will be travelling by plane as much. I mean, in UCC at the moment, we're told if we can have a meeting by Zoom or by Teams, don't fly to a meeting. And I also think that the idea of popping off to Seville for a weekend will probably not be there in 2040. I think we'll take a train to a ferry to France, a train from France to the south of France. I think we will have slower holidays, but travel by airline will go down as the cost goes up. So I think it will be a very different world if, and this depends on if, we get net zero aviation. And I suppose what we did in our research is we looked at what does net zero mean, and we provided evidence. So this is not my personal wish, but the evidence says net zero will be very, very expensive. Flying will become very, very expensive. There will then be less flying, so there'll be less fuel used, and aviation should reduce.
Will it, though, I'm wondering, will it reduce its emissions? Because it doesn't appear to be in anyone's interests to move first here, to be the market leader showing the way. And in the absence of leadership, you don't see anybody going at this concertedly.
I suppose a concern I would have is that aviation is international. And these emissions are in international airspace. So the EU, for example, has a target of 70% SAF by 2050. But you could imagine, for example, in America, if Trump is in power, that target mightn't be of interest. Or so if China and Russia and America don't have an interest in sustainable aviation fuel and Europe does, then Europe becomes anti-competitive. It will not be competitive with Russia and with America and with China. So there is a need for a global consensus for this to happen because aviation is international.
So when the aviation industry says, I'm sorry, I'm asking you to make a non-scientific assessment here. When the aviation industry says, look, guilt-free flying, net zero flying within our lifetimes is a very real possibility. Just go with us on this journey. Are they greenwashing?
Well, I suppose if we look at the target in Europe, it's 70% SAF. So that is still 30% jet fuel. And we will still have the non-CO2 warming of particulates and contrails. So it won't be net zero. And I do think a lot of our research in the MARI Centre in UCC is looking at these hard to decarbonise areas. And I do think net zero, mathematical net zero, won't happen in aviation. There'll have to be what we call negative emission technologies. And a negative emission technology is direct air carbon capture, pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and putting it underground. Again, very, very expensive. Okay. Because I do think the challenge is we can build a hospital for children, or we can pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and put it underground. Which wins?
But we can't do both. So when you put the limitations of the technology as you have described it alongside increase in passenger numbers and a desire to get off the island as the weather gets worse and worse and worse, how much less flying do you think we would have to do in order for the aviation industry to reach that net zero by 2050 target?
But I suppose the target isn't actually net zero. I mean, we're looking at 70% of SAF by 2050. So we're trying to reduce a huge problem on a worldwide basis.
Oh, no, I know that that's the EU target, but the industry has promised or made a commitment to get to net zero by 2050. So what I'm asking you is, have you any idea, any kind of a calculation as to how much we would have to decrease passenger numbers with the existing technology in order for that to be done?
I think, again, I'm not an economist, but I think the market would decide. I mean, back in the 1980s, I would have flown maybe once a year, England and back. My first flight, I was 23. And I think what's sad here is that our young generation at the moment, you know, can't afford to buy houses, but they can go to Seville and Barcelona and Rome. I think in 10, 15 years' time, as we employ these technologies, the cost of flying will be at such a level that they will not be able to afford to pop over to Barcelona or Seville, and they'll fly less because they won't afford it.
The good news alternative here, though, is that ferries don't fly at 30,000 feet, so don't do all of that high altitude polluting, and would be a very much greener alternative.
The shipping industry is looking at methanol, which is a liquid fuel. It's quite available. It's not as impactful on global warming because it's, as you said, it's burned at sea level. We can put in a biofuel, we can put in an e-fuel. It's cheaper and it isn't as much of a problem. So I do think that
it still involves the sacrifice of an awful lot of farmland, though, doesn't it?
It does, but again, it can be made from electricity and it can be made from carbon dioxide. It will be expensive, but I do see the future of travel probably being electric trains, ferries. I think our holidays will probably be longer. They'll be slower. We'll take 2 days to get to the south of France, 2 days to come back. It'll be by train, it'll be by ferry. I think that's the most sustainable way to travel. And it is very time consuming. It is extremely time consuming. So I think we'll have my perspective of decarbonisation is we will be slower. Things will be slower. We will have slow food movement. We'll have slow travel movement. We'll do things more sustainably.
Gerry Murphy, Professor and Director of MARAI in UCC. Thank you very much for talking to us.